So thank you all for coming. This is obviously the first lecture in our animal behavior course. The course is run by myself, Alex Jordan, along with Ian Cousin and Damien Farin. You'll be getting lectures from each of us interchangeably. We will publish the lecture schedule on Ilias for you as soon as that's all set up and organized. And we'll also be putting up the PDFs of each lecture. So I encourage you not to stress out too much about taking notes. For myself, for my own lectures, I really, really encourage you and will demand that you interact and answer questions and stop me if you have questions. Given that obviously this lecture series will be run in English, there may be some things that are not clear to you. And in that case, I encourage you to stop me and we can have a discussion. I think that's the best way to learn. And so I expect that from you. So let's first just introduce exactly who we all are, so you know who you're dealing with. The three lecturers of this course are all part of the Max Planck Institute for Ornithology. Ornithology meaning the study of birds. As you'll quickly find out, I certainly don't know anything about birds, and Ian Cousin knows also relatively little. Damien does know a bit about birds. Ian and I study fish primarily. You'll get a big introduction into a lot of what we do. Many of the examples that you'll be getting throughout the series of these lectures are from our own ongoing research, which is, of course, conducted here within the campus of the university where the Max Planck Institute is situated, but also many examples from field work in various parts of the world, which you'll also hear about. Okay, so this is Professor Cousin, who will be giving, I think, next week's lecture, the director of the Institute, whose primary focus is collective behavior, which is Schwarmverhalten, the ways in which individuals aggregate and congregate into groups to form collectives, and he studies the properties of those collectives. This is a photo from a little while ago, so he looks a bit different now. This is Damien. Damien studies social networks and behavior, primarily in birds, out in Mögingen, in Radolfzell, near Radolfzell. Also studies, along with Ari Strandberg-Peschken, some primate stuff. And then there's me. I study primarily cichlids, buntbarsch, in Lake Tanganyika in Africa. You'll hear a lot more about that. And my research spans all the way up to broad-scale ecological outcomes down to the neurobiological mechanisms of individuals in groups. We also study some social spiders. And if you ever come to my office, be warned that I do have some fairly large spiders above my desk. Okay, so let's start by asking the simple question, what is animal behavior? What are you studying here? What are these lectures going to be about? What comprises the study of how and why an animal behaves and performs different actions? And how are those actions subject to natural selection, the process which drives evolution? Of course, there's also sexual selection. And how do we understand the consequences and the expression of behavior? Primarily, this is broken down in typical study into four main categories or four ultimate questions based on Aristotle's ultimate causation. And these questions then are divided themselves into how and why questions. So if we define the study of animal behavior as is written up here on the board, that the study of how and why animals interact with one another and with their environments, those four bolded terms really capture the essence of the ways in which we study animal behavior. So how is the proximate questions? What are the mechanisms that produce behavior? You can think of these like reflex responses. If you get stuck with a sharp thing that's painful, you'll recoil. That's a very simple proximate mechanism, a reflex response. But obviously those mechanisms can be far more complicated and far more subtle and sophisticated, and really get down to perhaps often the neurobiological mechanisms of behavior. Then you have the types of questions that ask why. Why does an animal do a certain thing? Why are birds colorful? Why do they sing? Why anything? The why questions are for me, the more fascinating ones, because they're endless. We want to understand why things are the way they are. These questions are called the ultimate questions. They ask about what is the ultimate reason for the expression of animal behavior, and they're often situated in an evolutionary context. So we ask the question, what is the adaptive value? We're going to get to these points later, so don't worry too much just yet. But what is the adaptive value? What is the benefit that the animal would gain from doing this or not doing this? And also, what is the evolutionary history of the traits? That's very important, that we situate everything within the context of what has gone before. Obviously, evolution and natural selection are processes that occur over very long time periods. And so nothing arises out of nothing. Everything has a history, and that could place constraints or opportunities on the types of behavior that can be manifested. One another, this term one another, is a way to capture the fact that animal behavior almost never exists in a vacuum. No animals are ever really alone, humans included. Whether or not that's because they have some historical association that alters their subsequent behavior or their perception of the world, or in the sense that most animals are currently interacting with predators, with prey, with conspecifics. Conspecifics means the same species, or heterospecifics, different species. So the expression of behavior will be a function and a consequence of the social environment that these animals are in. This is going to be a core theme of a lot of the examples you get, because obviously coming from the Department of Collective Behavior, we study social interactions primarily. Then, of course, there's the environment. And the environment in this statement typifies and specifies all of the other stuff that the animals are dealing with. The weather, the rocks, the food, everything that could otherwise be characterized as abiotic factors. But this is, of course, open to debate. A big question for me and for everyone, I think, is why we study animal behavior. And the answer is obvious, because it's great. It's cool. Animals do amazing things. They're beautiful. They do amazing things in amazing places. It's an incredible opportunity to study the natural world in a way that's characterized often on television. You know, this is wonderful stuff to look at. And so the answer to why we study animal behavior for me is very simple. And I think probably for many of you, hopefully, it's also that you inherently find this a fascinating subject. That the manifestation of all the different types of behaviors and the colors and the interactions and the different species and the places in the world that animal behavior occurs, even if it's outside at the bus stop, means it's a fascinating and rewarding field of study. But of course, it's a very difficult field of study. If you're to study animal behavior where it occurs, that involves being in some sometimes difficult places, which we'll talk about later, and it can be very difficult to interpret why animals behave the way they do. As humans, we are very, very good at inferring causation. We look at a pattern and we think we know why it happens. That is a very dangerous trait for a scientist, because if you believe that based on your own experiences, these animals have similar outlooks on the world or have similar ways of synthesizing information, that can be very misleading. And so we have to be very methodical and scientific about the study of animal behavior, even though it's inherently cool and we like it. And this is the great tension, I think, of animal behavioral scientists that must be resolved. Nevertheless, for me, if I answer this question, why do I study animal behavior? It's not to be a lecturer. It's not to stand up in front of you guys, as much as I do like that, of course. It's not to have a job. But it's because every day I find it exciting and a wonderful challenge. But it is a very difficult challenge and also very difficult to get a job in animal behavior, so keep that in mind. So let's talk about the history of animal behavior, of the history of studying animal behavior, rather. The history of animal behavior, of course, goes back to the first animals, whenever they were, and whatever your definitions there are. But the history of studying animal behavior probably started very early on in human history and had much to do not with the inherent academic pursuit of knowledge, but rather survival value. If you understand what animals do and where they are, it's easier to kill them and eat them. This is probably the reality and probably underlies some or much of the research still today going on in animal behavior. Some of the first examples of recorded animal behavior, of course, are these cave paintings, where you can see already that these artists knew that these livestock or these ungulates did not exist in isolation. They drew many of them together. They also drew many examples of how they hunt these animals and the strategies that they use. So they have some inherent understanding, obviously, of the way these animals behave. But then for the more formal recordings of animal behavior, some of the earliest examples are with Aristotle in his Historia Animalism, where he started to record examples of observations that he had taken on many of the animals around. And those methods and early descriptions actually formed much of the basis of subsequent animal behavioral studies. And of course, Aristotle and many of the contemporaries at that time named some of the first animals and started to give them formal classifications, culminating in the Linnaean system of nomenclature. There's also a question here about what really animal behavior is. There's no sort of degree that I've heard of that you can take in animal behavior. In high school, there's very unlikely to be a subject called animal behavior, but there are subjects called chemistry and physics and biology. And that probably reflects the fact, A, that there's not many jobs in animal behavior, so, you know, not a very responsible thing to teach people. I mean, I should be careful here. I think it's the most important thing to study, of course, but as a high school subject, it's not as useful at a broad scale as would be chemistry, for example. But also it reflects the fact that animal behavior is no single field. It's a composite of numerous disciplines and approaches that are all centered on this question: why and how do animals perform the behaviors that they do? And in that sense, it comprises other more formalized fields. The first, and probably the one you think of immediately, is ethology. Ethology is the study of behavior, whether that's animal behavior or human behavior. And it's the formalization of the description of behavior. In that sense, it's considered a particularly archaic or historical field, because the age of simply describing behavior sort of ended. And I say sort of because it's sort of making a comeback with modern computational methods, which are exciting and very fascinating. Of course, developmental biology plays a huge role. How do animals develop over time, over their ontogeny, to be able to produce behavior? It's essential to understand that facet. Babies cannot do the same things as adult humans. And so an understanding of developmental biology, of limb development, of brain development, of cellular development, are all essential components of the questions about animal behavior and can comprise entire fields of study. Evolutionary behavioral ecology. Behavioral ecology is the study of animals in their natural context, of behavior where that behavior has evolved. So typically you might consider this field biology. What you think of as field biology is probably much of what behavioral ecology is. And here we put in parentheses evolutionary behavioral ecology, because there's a very famous statement by Theodosius Dobzhansky, who said, "Nothing in biology makes sense except in the light of evolution." And we cannot understand why animals are performing behaviors and why those behaviors are selected for unless we place them in the context of the evolutionary history and current selective environment that they're being expressed. So evolutionary behavioral ecology has largely replaced behavioral ecology. Behavioral genetics is obviously hugely important, as is broadly speaking genetics, because that gives us the basis for understanding how selection operates. Selection changes allele frequencies in subsequent generations, And so if a behavior is selected for, that is, it is good for the animal, and it has a genetic basis, then we would expect to see more genes producing that behavior in subsequent generations. But to make that calculation and make that assessment, we need to know about behavioral genetics, about how genes encode behavior. And that is not always obvious. In fact, it is never obvious. It's a fascinating field of study, behavioral genetics, but it's largely restricted to model organisms, Drosophila, C. elegans, zebrafish, because it's such a complicated field of study that to then bring that out into the world, into the field, introduces a lot of complexities that are currently very difficult to deal with. Although here in our department, we are one of the groups in the world that is trying to deal with that complexity. More and more, I've been here in Konstanz for just a little over 2 years. The sort of first week I arrived, I gave this lecture about 2 years ago. And even in that time, more and more, the field of computational biology and computational ethology is starting to take over our discipline. That is a very good thing in many ways. It's also a little bit scary to think that the robots are going to take our jobs. But this is something that must be understood in the current generation. Unfortunately, the age of going into the forest with a notepad and pen and recording what you see is no longer sufficient. So we have to include modern computational approaches. That means that even, I won't say dinosaurs like me, but people like me have to now be coding heavily in Python every day rather than watching fish tanks. That's the reality of the job, and it's the reality of the discipline. It does generate incredible new insight. Much of what I'll show you over the course of my lectures will be about employing computational techniques, neural network analyses, deep learning detection algorithms, T-SNE embedding of behaviors. All of these things rely heavily on current generation computational approaches. Biophysics is a huge part of understanding why an animal does something and how it does it. Because if you think about a fish swimming and a bird flying, the biophysics of those two situations are very, very different. They require very different architectures, very different behaviors are possible in the two media, air and water in this case. And the way that these animals express behavior may be a function and a consequence of the biophysical properties of the world that they inhabit. And of course, neurobiology. Neurobiology is central to everything we do when we're asking about the mechanisms that produce behavior. Behavior is typically a cognitive process. It's a decision process to do one thing versus another thing, even in the lowest or the most simple organisms. And therefore, it touches on the neurobiology of learning, of decision-making, of sensory processing and input. So much of modern animal behavior comprises neurobiology. And there is an excellent course here from Professor Galizia, which I hope some of you have taken or plan to take on neurobiology. Ah, there's the video. Okay. What I want to do now is for you guys to tell me what kinds of animal behaviors there are. Here are a couple of examples. But I just want to get you guys to start to talk about what you think animal behavior is, and then we can come up with some examples of the kinds of things that animals do and perhaps get to the point where we're discussing why and how they do those things. So, can anyone give me an example of an animal behavior? Nest building, yep, in what kind of animal? So, nest building as a form of shelter, yep. Yep, good. Anything else? So here is actually a test of psychology about whether you're willing to put up your hand, because of course you all know an animal behavior. And you can hide in the beginning of lecture so you seem cool until the end, but I'll get you eventually. Yep. So why would an animal fight for territory? So it's protecting some resource, maybe a food resource, maybe mating resources, maybe it's where its nest is, maybe it's where its young are, so it's defending its young. Mating display. Uh-huh. And why do birds dance? Why don't they? Or what is it about the dance that's important? The answer to the question was that it's a display that the male, if we're talking about males, okay, let's say we are, is of high enough quality that they can afford to perform a ridiculous display that's otherwise costly. This is something we will discuss in some detail. But I want to ask the question, are all of the dances the same? Does every bird dance in the same way? That's within a species, you mean. So there's variation within the males of a species in how they dance, and that may contain information that the female could use to choose amongst those males. And all species, what about different species? Do they all perform the same dance? No, they don't. And that could be very important because one of the primary reasons for some of these displays might be species recognition, right? It's not good to mate with a different species. Then you get mules and asses and things that aren't particularly useful. This is called outbreeding depression in the technical sense. Okay, so let's look at some other very cool behaviors, because a lot of the sort of animal behaviors that we know and spring to mind. So some of these are the sort of things that stick in your mind when you think about animal behavior, right? These incredible displays of birds of paradise as you guys said, with the dancing and with all of the fabulous movements and stereotyped displays and creation of territories and nests and bowers and clearing patches of forest. And so, of course, these are some of the sort of classic and characteristic animal behaviors that we think about, but these need not be all of the animal behaviors, and of course many of them are very subtle. Vigilance behavior, looking around, trying not to be eaten, these are behaviors. Breathing, eating, all of these things, communicating, all of these things are animal behaviors. And so all of them comprise the field of study of animal behavior. That's not to say that these are any less valuable. These are certainly fascinating types of behaviors, and a big part of my research looks at male courtship display, this very behavior, and how it interacts in a competitive, collective context. Okay, but ultimately, animal behavior, whatever forms it takes, is for something. And we can call that, with a bit of humor perhaps, the four Fs of animal behavior that comprise pretty much every single behavior can be put into one of these categories. So of course, feeding. Much of what we see in animal behavior is about getting food, getting resources, getting enough energy to do the rest of the behaviors. Much of the competition, which of course falls into fighting, is over food resources. Fleeing is sort of describing predator avoidance. So much of animal behavior is about not being killed. The world is a very, very cruel place, and humans have, through our the evolution of greater cognitive capacity perhaps, escaped some of that pressure. We don't have lions and tigers in the hallways anymore about to kill us. But that's not true for most animals. So a lot of what animals are doing, and especially in collective behavior, is about not being killed. And then, of course, reproduction, the finding of mates, is the final category, which, of course, is the imperative function if you're going to leave behind offspring in subsequent generations. And that's how natural selection works. All it looks at is how many copies of your genes are in the next generation, and that drives the path of evolution. Some people have a big problem with evolutionary theory and fight against it, especially in the US, where I used to teach at the University of Texas. And it's such a simple concept that it's just baffling that people have so much trouble with it and start to talk about impossible randomness and these things and mutations. It's far more direct and easily to understand than that. Now, of course, then there are behaviors that are very difficult as a human observer to understand. You know, this is, again, this point that I make, that as humans, we assign causality to many things we observe. It's very helpful for us to hear a tree fall in the woods or a branch crack and make up a story about what that is. It's not a tiger, it's not something about to eat me, it's just a coconut falling. But this is also dangerous because we may incorrectly describe a behavior based on our feeling and be very unscientific about it. And so here's an example. I was interviewed about this. This was a discovery by a Japanese group about 5 years ago now, where they recorded an animal doing this behavior, and nobody could understand why they were doing it for some years. So let's have a look at it. And then we'll talk about what you think is going on here. Okay, what do we think? What is this? It's a fish, if you didn't get that, that's a fish. It's a tetradontid, a box fish or a goat fish. I actually don't know the name in German, but tetradontidae. Fugu, it's the poisonous Japanese fish that is still prepared for sushi. Anyway, that doesn't really matter. At about 50 meters depth, this thing does this. These fish make these great circles that look like crop circles or artistic patterns all over the seafloor. Yeah? So, any ideas of what this is for? So the reason that was initially not thought to be the case is that the males build them and then leave. So they just build these things. They're not on them. So after they build them, they don't seem to use them. Any other ideas? For orientation, cool. Yeah, nice idea. Maybe, yeah. Yeah, anything else? So it's possible, of course, that we're looking for reasons for things that have no reasons. There's a paper called The Spandrels of St. Mark's Cathedral, a critique of the Panglossian paradigm. I'll put it up online. And it came out in the 70s by Stephen Jay Gould, who has written some other popular science books, maybe some of them you know. And it made the point that for many scientists and behavioral biologists, we try to tell stories about the things we see and we say what they're for, when many times they are not for anything. They are a consequence of selection on other things. The chin is a good example. What is our chin for? To display our wonderful beards, perhaps? What's the chin for? Why do you have a chin? The chin probably isn't for anything. It's a consequence of the fact that there's selection on our jawbone to house our teeth, and we have teeth on two sides, and they have to come together somewhere, and that's our chin, right? We have this prominent thing, but it's not for anything. Now, I'm not saying that's true, right? Maybe we discover that the chin is for something. But the point is, you cannot ascribe purpose to things without scientifically examining that. Okay, so I'll tell you what the current thinking of this is, and it's actually almost a combination of all of these things. What the male does is build these channels in the sand that change the way the water flows over them. And so the water flow is coming to a central point from every direction. Yeah? In the microclimate of this little channels, the water is flowing inwards. He uses this maybe as an ornament, but maybe just as a place in which to mate with the female so that most of his sperm, which may otherwise get swept away by the currents, ends up on her eggs. And they did this by testing if they put dye here, and saw that it always flowed into the center of this structure. Interestingly as well, you notice there's a different kind of sand the male uses in each part. Very fine sand here for smooth flow, and very rough sand outside. This is not particularly well understood why this happens. But it's a great example of an unknown behavior then being examined, and some of the reasons or perhaps the potential mechanisms being uncovered through formal study. And this is effectively what we do in animal behavior. I mentioned already that evolution really is the conceptual framework in which we study behavior. And I'm sure all of you have heard of Charles Darwin, who formalized the field of evolution, who gave it that name. But of course, Huxley and some people before Darwin also contributed heavily to the development of evolution as a formal field of study, not least Alfred Wallace, a contemporary of Darwin, who came up with the theory of evolution independently of Charles Darwin, sent Charles Darwin a letter saying that he had come up with this theory of evolution. And then Charles Darwin went ahead and published his book immediately to get it out first. And to be fair, he had come up with the idea 20 years earlier. He was just very slow in publishing his book. This gave him a little bit of fire under his bum. But then there's been a series of subsequent researchers that have gone even further to formalize the field. Fisher in the field of quantitative genetics, Ernst Mayr, Bill Hamilton in terms of inclusive fitness theory, which we'll get to, E.O. Wilson looking at sociobiology and how social interactions, Richard Dawkins, who you may know, wrote The Selfish Gene, the extended phenotype, and then went a bit crazy and started writing religious books, whatever, and Theodosius Dobzhansky, also in the field of genetics. And the basic idea is that you have descent with modification, right? Things start in a certain place. In our case, if we're talking about animal behavior, there may be very simple behaviors. You chase after food, you avoid being eaten by moving in an XY plane. And then subsequent generations have a more complex type of behavior. They now can not just go laterally, but they can also go up and down. Maybe this is how it happens. And that might require only the evolution of some new muscle or a muscle being changed in its function to change the orientation of an animal and then open up new avenues for types of behavior. And that's really the story of how we understand behavior. Where was it and what is it now? What is it for, and what was it in the initial state, and what has changed? Okay, so importantly, this is the only time we're going to talk about selection, which is a shame that we don't have an entire course on evolution. Maybe in the future we will, but just to give you a very brief crash course in how selection operates. Selection will look at a population. Here we have a population of flowers, and they have different genotype frequencies. Yeah, so we have 0.7 of this red phenotype, which is encoded by the dominant R allele here. So both the heterozygotes and the homozygotes have the red phenotype. And then there's some difference in the way they leave behind offspring. Okay, and this is also the basis of selection. More offspring are produced than can survive. This is Malthus' principle. Yeah? And so that generates the raw material on which selection can act. If there weren't more than produced than can survive, then selection wouldn't be able to push populations in any direction. And so then because whether through some random or drift process or some active selection, like for example the red flowers are better at something, better at being pollinated by bees, better at surviving the sunlight or whatever it is, by some difference in that process, the allele frequencies now have changed in the subsequent population. Yeah? And in this example, they go to fixation. Yeah? This is called fixation when only one of the alleles is present. In this case, it's the dominant allele, which is actually fairly common. But all I want to emphasize is that the process of selection is simply a change in allele frequencies over time. And those alleles could encode for behavior. It's very, very rare. We think, anyway, it's very rarely reported that a single gene or allele encodes for a behavior, because behaviors are so complex. And so typically it's multiple genes or multiple alleles of small effect that encode for behavior. So the selection process and the process of animal behavioral evolution looks almost nothing like this, except in principle. And that's the principle I want to just communicate to you. So the early researchers that examined animal behavior had some pretty wild ideas about that. And of course, that makes you wonder if the future generations will look at our ideas and think they're equally crazy. Probably they will. And that's the nice thing about science. You're never actually right. You're just on the path, hopefully, towards being more right, although not always. And so the field of ethology was developed as a formalized method to study behavior, because prior to that, much of the justification for different kinds of animal behavior was based on things like animals just wanted to dance. Okay, so your answers about why male birds do courtship displays were not considered necessarily. I mean, the field of sexual selection didn't exist. Mate choice didn't exist. And so the argument was that animals simply had too much energy, right? They ate too much food and they just needed to dance it off. Sounds a bit crazy, but this is what they thought. And then came this formalized theory of ethology, which went through methodically and described all the different kinds of behaviors, in what sequence they occurred, when they occurred, inferred why they occurred, and then allowed a sort of template, a formalized template, to compare amongst species and amongst individuals in how the behaviors differed. And that also led us to be able to understand early on instinctual behaviors. So probably you've heard about birds that will roll anything that looks like an egg towards their nest. And stickleback, for instance, always attacking anything red. There was a famous scientist, Tinbergen, who observed through this process, the process of ethology, that every day at 3 p.m., the stickleback, stickling, this type of fish in his tank, would go nuts in the tank. They would start to really go crazy and be aggressive. And he couldn't figure it out. Why 3 p.m. did this happen every day? And then he realized that at 3 p.m. every day, the postman arrived outside of his window in a red van. And the stickleback have an inherent, innate intolerance of red, because the males have red coloration in their throat when they're in breeding season. And so males become very aggressive towards red stimuli. And so this was apparently the justification, or at least this is how the story goes, of how Tinbergen came to understand the valence of this red signal. As an example, though, of breaking down a behavior into its constituent parts and formalizing the sequence of behaviors, this guy, I can't pronounce that name, perhaps you guys can, let's call him Jacob, studied ticks searching for a blood meal. Okay, and so let's throw it to you guys. Ticks are these little parasites, I'm sure you know them, they're very common around here, and can carry some pretty bad diseases in this part of the world. Why do ticks suck blood? Do we know? Why and how? Let's just make up a story here. Nutrition, right? They want something to eat. Simple, yeah? That's why they suck blood. How do they suck blood? How does a tick get on you? Okay, so they go up on the grass, yeah? And they grab onto you when you pass, yeah? Does everyone agree with this? Yeah? So how do they do these processes is the question. What are the terminology was, what are the sign stimuli that allow the animal to perform this sequence of behaviors? This is the question. And so just as a nice video, this is what it kind of looks like. Can be thought of as pretty gross, but so here you have a tick doing a behavior. Again, this is what we talked about. You're walking through perhaps the forest or a woodland area, and here's the tick that goes up on a grass, piece of grass. So it's elevated. It's up in an elevated position, and it waits there. Yeah, and it waits for something to pass by, which should happen momentarily. There we leave it. Okay, we'll just fill in that part of the story. So when something does pass by, oh no, here we go. It attaches onto that passerby. And here's a question. How does it know what is a passerby or just a leaf or something else? The question should be in your mind. And then it's able to attach. This is taking a while. Yeah, we get it. Okay, something passed by. Great, there you are. You walk by, it grabs on. And now it's on your skin. And now it's looking for a place that it's going to get a blood meal from you. And this gets a bit gross. When it finds a place, however it does that, it will, come on. Okay, there it is, nasty. Okay, we don't really need to see this. Okay, here we go. It finds a suitable location, and then the magic happens with its serrated proboscis. The palps open up, penetrate the skin in a very sort of disgusting sawing motion to tear away at your skin. And it has this sort of staged process where it's going further and further in until it can extend this hypostome here and find a place where it can start to suck your blood in a similar way, of course, to a mosquito. And there it attaches. And you can see it's very good at attaching because of the serrations on this proboscis. Very difficult to get out, as of course you know. And there it just engorges itself on this blood meal of yours. Okay. So let's talk about really how that happens. And that's what, of course, this study addressed. Okay, so the first thing to note is that it's only the females that have blood, that take blood meals. Yeah? They need those blood meals to produce eggs and offspring, the high protein input of the blood, similar to mosquitoes. Only female mosquitoes bite humans. Okay, and then the first thing is that immature females are only sensitive to light. Yeah? They move towards light, just like plants. This is a simple mechanism, but it is effective in getting them up off the ground to the tips of these grass shoots, so that they're in a position to grab onto things that pass by, okay? Very simple mechanism. It's not that they know that they need to be up high. It's not that they have a plan and they think, ha-ha, the humans will be walking past this spot. I'll go up and I'll hold on and I'll get one. No, it's a sign stimulus. They just move towards light. Secondly, they become sensitive to this acid, butyric acid, okay? And only mammals produce this, okay? So they smell this in the air. That means they don't grab on to other things that are not useful hosts. In this case, it restricts them to passing mammals. So here we have two very simple mechanisms. Go towards light and then move towards this acid source. Those two mechanisms are very effective in making them end up on a mammal. Now they are only sensitive to temperature. So they're on the mammal and they go to the warmest or a warm place. And in that place, they will suck any warm liquid. Three very simple mechanisms that direct the animal up onto a mammal and towards the blood. Of course, they could all fail, and that's what this experiment shows, that you can trick them by giving them these stimuli in the wrong order or in the wrong place, and they will simply suck any warm liquid. But selection, acting on this behavioral process, is sufficient, or rather, this behavioral process is sufficient to get them a blood meal in enough cases that it's subject to positive selection. And so this is an important aspect to understanding animal behavior, of course, because we may, as humans, invoke cognition or causality that this animal does not have, right? We may think that it's strategizing on how best to get a blood meal, but really, when you break it down here to this great German term that I quite like, the Umwelt of the animal, it's only these three things that matter in getting this behavior to manifest. And it is quite a complex behavior. That said, these kind of examples are rare where the behavior is so simple. And they're also not only instinctual. This case was in a hardwired instinctual behavior that every one of these animals does. But that is not always true. Behaviors can be learned, they can change, they may have very different ways of interacting with their environment and with other aspects of the behaving animal. And that's a message that we'll keep pressing throughout this course, that behavior is very complex and we need very complex ways to study it. Now let's talk about the formal birth of the field of animal behavior. And that really started with the Nobel Prize of Tinbergen and Lorenzen von Frisch, who received the Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine, of course, because there is no Nobel Prize for basic sciences, for the discoveries concerning organization and elicitation of individual and social behavior patterns. A very, very general statement, because these three researchers studied very, very different things, but they needed a catch-all term. But it was Nico Tinbergen in particular, this top guy, who formalized this study of animal behavior with these four main questions that I made a prelude to earlier on. And so we're going to go through these four questions and ask how they're applied and what insight they can give us into animal behavior as a field. Okay, so the first of Tinbergen's four questions, this is important, so pay attention to this part of the lecture. Tinbergen's four questions, the first question is causation or mechanism. How is the behavior produced? Or more explicitly, what is the physiological causation of the behavior? Yeah, and we're going to get to that with examples. The second is ontogeny or acquisition over development. Does the behavior grow effectively? How does the animal acquire this behavior? Many behaviors, of course, are learned. And if a behavior is learned, it has a period of development from a point where it doesn't occur to a point where it does occur. And we're going to talk about many of those aspects as well. The first two were these how questions. How does it happen? The second two are these why questions. And the first of the why questions is probably the one you most commonly inherently think about, which is the survival value or the adaptive value. What is it for? What is it good for? Why do the animals do this? What benefit or cost is there that's inherent in this behavior? And the fourth question is the evolution or evolutionary history of the behavior. Where did it come from? What were the progenitors to this behavior? Okay? And this is very important because it means that not all animals can do all behaviors. There are some things we cannot do. We cannot swim particularly well because we don't have an ancestry of swimming animals. Yeah, so we can't suddenly give birth to a whale. It just does not work like that. It sounds trivial, but it's not. And we'll get to that. And so we'll do birdsong as a worked example, and I'll give you this example because it's the last time I'll talk about birds, but at least I can try to give you one example in that field. You'll get plenty of other bird examples as we go through. So the question is, how and why does this male bird sing? And we're going to try and answer that question at these four levels: mechanism, ontogeny, adaptive significance, and history. What is the mechanism? So let's throw to you guys. How does a bird make this song? Cool, exactly. The syrinx is the word you're looking for. Is that the way all animals sing, just as an aside? Is it the way humans sing? Do you know the name? Mannequin is one of them. This snapping. It was in that video. If we had sound, you would have heard it. Yep. Are there any other animals that produce noise? How do insects produce sound or songs? So crickets, for example, krille, make this chirping sound by vibrating their wing against a file. Yeah, so of course, in the bird, it's quite similar to the way humans produce sound, but it need not always be like that. And this is, of course, driven by both the neural code that's encoding for the animal wanting to make this sound, but also by all of the architecture that sends from the brain signals to the musculature to change the tension on this on the syrinx to change the pitch of the song. So that's the basic mechanism by which it's produced. Very basic, but that's the mechanism. And what about ontogeny, growth? Do baby birds come out singing? This is not an easy answer, actually, because there's multiple answers. Yep. So they have the machinery, like the last step, in place. But can they sing full songs? Anyone have any idea how they come to know songs? Many songbirds learn their song from demonstrators. Again, just like the tick example, usually that demonstrator is their father, because usually that's the animal with which they have most experience, yeah? And so usually it works, but you can mess it up. There's the classic or famous perhaps example you've seen of David Attenborough filming the Australian lyrebird, and the lyrebird makes telephone noises and camera click noises and all of these things because that's the noises that it's been exposed to and it's imitating. Lyrebirds are, of course, a very extreme case because their whole biology and behavior is about imitation, not true for every bird. But in the case of many songbirds, they have to be exposed to this process or these stimuli of others singing. And then that's encoded in the brain in various ways that we'll talk about. And so over time, this song crystallizes. It goes from a very basal form where they're singing, but they're not good at it. It's a song that sort of sounds like the real thing, but isn't exactly. And then over time, this song crystallizes and becomes a better representation or a true representation of the demonstrator's song. Why do birds sing? What's the adaptive significance of singing? Tell me about the male-female case. What is the male communicating to the female? So they're letting them know, A, that they're a bird, B, that they're a bird of the same species, C, that they're a male bird, and D, that they're ready to mate. Yeah? And as I think someone over here mentioned, maybe it infers or signifies some degree of quality about that male, how good that male is. Okay? What about in the male-male case? Why would male birds listen to each other's songs? So they can detect each other's presence, whether there's a competitor in the region already. This is exactly what you guys just said, to attract mates and perhaps as a territorial signal. And so we can study this formally, of course. We can look at how many notes a male has in his song, or how many songs he knows, and his reproductive success. And then we get a direct measurement of this relationship, okay? We know that if you sing more and better, you may have higher reproductive success, and that may be achieved through, for instance, attracting more females to your nest or to breed with you, although it could be for some other ways. So we know, effectively, that's why they sing. That's what it's for. It's for attracting mates to produce more offspring or driving away competitors. Okay, and here is the evolutionary history aspect, this aspect of ultimate causation. And here's the one that sounds a bit silly, of course, but the question here is, why do songbirds sing? Well, it's because they're songbirds, right? That's why they sing. And it sounds ridiculous, but of course it's not, because what otherwise could it be? Right? All your ancestors were songbirds and they all sung. You share all of the genes in common with them. And so you have the genetic composition to sing. So therefore you can. And that's because you're a songbird. This is an important aspect, not only in this gross sense where, okay, you sing because you're a songbird, but it places in the context of what kind of behaviors you can do depend on what kind of animal you are. And that means what kind of animal your ancestors were, right? You're limited in what kind of behaviors you can do by your evolutionary history. Now, that was basically a historical sweep all the way up to the present day of generally the themes and the approaches in animal behavior. But animal behavior in the 21st century is a bit of a different beast because of all the new tools and technologies that we have available to us, allowing us to answer and ask these questions in very different ways. We can use highly quantitative computational techniques to gather data of a degree and kind that we never could before, with tracking animals, with behavioral decomposition through computational algorithms, with massive simulations, and perhaps you've heard of Icarus, for example, the satellite that was just launched about a month ago that has the capacity to track every single animal on Earth that can wear a tag about the size of a gram. Okay, that was just brought up to the space station a month ago and will come online in a few months as part of our institute. We can also study animals in naturally complex contexts. That means that we don't have to take animals out of the wild and put them in a box alone and see what they do when we electrocute them or some other weird thing. We can actually study them where they want to be, where they evolved to be. That wasn't always possible. It typically meant you would have to go into these places with very little equipment and just describe what the animals were doing. But now we can bring these quantitative techniques into these naturally complex contexts. We can also understand the neuroethology. What are the basic, or not the basic, but what are the processes in the brain that underlie these behaviors? So we can ask how they're produced and what might go on when they change in terms of the mechanisms that produce them. And of course, with modern phylogenetic approaches, we can understand far better through the genomic revolution, for instance, the evolutionary history of these traits and species. So one thing I want to focus on here is this field called computational ethology, which is effectively taking the ethological approaches, for instance, these ethograms, all of the different types of behavior, and putting them into an agnostic, rather than a human saying this is what this is, algorithms that have no inherent bias, we hope and we assume, describing all of the things that an animal is doing, so we have a far greater insight into all of the different ways behavior can be manifested. And so this is done typically through visual approaches, through visual computing, by taking, for instance, a recording, in this case from above, of an animal, a fish swimming or a worm moving, and that obviously generates many, many thousands of dimensions of complexity, okay? It's got many, many pixels that can move in many, many directions, and that's very difficult kind of data stream to deal with. So we have to squash down all that information with this dimensionality reduction phase and then try and situate these different behaviors, if that's what they are, in some kind of dimension space here, or some kind of heat histogram like here. To give you an example, I think we'll skip that, but this is what it looks like. So we can have an animal freely moving about in space, and then we can calculate all of the different things that it does and situate them in any kind of two-dimensional space or one-dimensional space in any kind of embedding that you like. This is called a T-SNE space, a T-stochastic near-neighbor embedded space. It need not be that, of course, but this is the most common. And then you can break down the behaviors by this further categorization process called watersheding into the things that you understand. Now, this stage is a little bit subjective because this is the raw output of all the different behaviors that this animal can produce as detected by the algorithm. And then this is how we interpret those behaviors. And we do that by looking at the behavior here and seeing how the behavior is mapped in this space and then what label we might give it. Now, this is very important because traditionally we would do it the other way around. We would look at the animal and we would come up with these categories that are popping up down here. And we wouldn't really know where they began and ended. or have any kind of way to compare them amongst different observers. You would look at it and write down one thing, I would look at it and write down perhaps another thing, even if we trained together a lot. Here, we have a raw output of the behavior that we can then both look at and argue all we want. Now, that's very important because it gives us the same data set to argue over, and rather than some arbitrary division that can never be resolved. Obviously, as well, it's incredibly detailed. It's incredibly quantitative, which could reveal new types of behaviors that we didn't see. And also importantly, it's automated. So we can look at numerous individuals at the same time and ask what they're all doing in relation to one another. We can look at how they interact. For example, here we have a male and a female, and we can look at here a male chasing a female and displaying to her, and look at how their two behavioral states change and interact as a function of one another. This is the essence of collective behavior. We want to know what one individual does and what effect that has on other individuals around it. To give you a real-world example, this is my own research. And this is a video stream from Lake Tanganyika in Africa. And here we have these fish moving around in the world, and we affix barcodes to them, although in fact we've since moved on from that and now use deep learning networks to automatically detect these fish in these scenes. And then we track them through the world as they get attacked by predators, as they look for food, as they move together and swim around. And use these computational approaches to break down all of the different kinds of behaviors that they do, and ask how those behaviors are linked and affect one another. Here's what it looks like in the track. Hey, that's weird. Because it went widescreen. And so here we have, as you can see, in a very, very difficult visual scene in the wild, in natural contexts, we have these animals moving around and all of their motions and interactions being tracked. And in fact, we can then overlay onto that a computation and a calculation of the structural world in which they move. So with these modern computational approaches, not only can we understand the behavior, but we can also recreate the entire visual scene, for instance, in this case, these rocks, through which they move, and we can see when they have to go around large rocks or split, or when they get attacked. And we can also understand, of course, what they are seeing as they move around in the world by reconstructing these visual scenes that the fish are experiencing. What it allows us to do is take these techniques that were developed in Drosophila and these other model organisms all the way out into one of the most remote places in the world, in Africa, and do the same kinds of analyses, giving incredibly great insight into the behaviors that these guys are showing. For instance, here they've come across a rock that's very large, and they've had to make a decision to split. Two of them go one way and the rest go the other, and then of course they rejoin. What this also allows us to do is break down all the different behaviors that they produce, so we have quantitative signatures of these behaviors. So here I want you to look at this green fish, which is being tracked, and it'll loop around, and you're going to see this fish do this characteristic driving display where it digs in the sediment, just like that fish I showed you earlier. And we actually don't know, there it is, what that behavior is for. We don't know why they do this. But the question we ask is, what is the probability of a behavioral change in the other animals when that animal does that behavior? Okay? And that can teach us what that behavior is for. And with these methods, we don't have to go through and watch hours and hours and hours of video to understand these things, because we can see it pops up this behavior very, very cleanly if we just look at the speed of the animal and multiply that by its turning angle. So then we're able to pull out these techniques in automated ways and then break down all of the different behaviors that these animals produce. And so here's that track again of those animals moving through the world, and the colors represent which behavioral state they're in. Okay? And so we know who's doing what, when, who they were with when they were doing it, in what contexts, and what kinds of attributes in terms of their movement and interaction contributed to those behaviors. Effectively, it means that we can now bring super modern approaches and techniques to some of the big questions in the places where they should be asked, which was never before achievable. Okay, so effectively, we have the same approaches, the same general conceptual techniques based on the original guys in this field, guys and girls, but now we can combine them with modern data-driven techniques that really are at the forefront of many, many fields, computational biology, visual computation, genetics, and all of these things, to have a fresh look and a more in-depth look at these age-old questions, hopefully coming up with new insight into them. Okay, I will leave it there.